half smile curving his thin mouth until his father was screaming insults at him, insults that were blunted by Colin's innate dislike of swearing, his self-consciousness when he did it.
"You cocky, self-centred, little shit!"
he screamed, and Tessa, whose eyes were so full of tears that she could barely see the road, was sure that Fats would be duplicating Colin's timid, falsetto swearing for the benefit of Andrew Price tomorrow morning. "Fats does a great imitation of Cubby's walk, miss. Have you seen it?"
"How dare you talk to me like that? How dare you skip classes?"
Colin screamed and raged, and Tessa had to blink the tears out of her eyes as she took the turning to Pagford and drove through the central square, past Mollison and Lowe, the War Memorial and the Black Cannon. She turned left at St. Michael and All Saints into Church Row and at last into the driveway of their house, by which time Colin had shouted himself into squeaky hoarseness and Tessa's cheeks were glazed and salty. When they all got out, Fats, whose expression had not altered a whit during his father's long diatribe, let himself in through the front door with his own key and proceeded upstairs at a leisurely pace without looking back. Colin threw his briefcase down in the dark hall and rounded on Tessa. The only illumination came from the stained glass panel over the front door, which cast strange colours over his agitated, domed and balding head, half bloody, half ghostly blue.
"Do you see?" he cried, waving his long arms. "Do you see what I'm dealing with?"
"Yes," she said, taking a handful of tissues from the box on the hall table and mopping her face, blowing her nose. "Yes, I do."
"Not a thought in his head for what we're going through," said Colin,
and he started to sob, big, whooping, dry sobs like a child with croup. Tessa hurried forward and put her arms around Colin's chest, a little above his waist, for short and stout as she was, that was the highest bit she could reach. He stooped, clinging to her. She could feel his trembling and the heaving of his ribcage under his coat. After a few minutes, she gently disengaged herself, led him into the kitchen, and made him a pot of tea. "I'm going to take a casserole up to Mary's," said Tessa, after she'd sat for a while stroking his hand. "She's got half the family there. We'll get an early night once I'm back." He nodded and sniffed, and she kissed him on the side of his head before heading out to the freezer. When she came back, carrying the heavy, icy dish, he was sitting at the table, cradling his mug in his big hands, his eyes closed. Tessa set down the casserole, wrapped in a polythene bag, on the tiles beside the front door. She pulled on the lumpy green cardigan she often wore instead of a jacket, but did not put on her shoes. Instead, she tiptoed upstairs to the landing and then, taking less trouble to be quiet, up the second flight to the loft conversion. A swift burst of rat-like activity greeted her approach to the door. She knocked, giving Fats time to hide whatever it was he'd been looking at online, or perhaps the cigarettes he did not know she knew about. "Yeah." She pushed open the door. Her son was crouching stagily over his school bag. "Did you have to play truant today of all days?" Fats straightened up, long and stringy. He towered over his mother. "I was there. I came in late. Bennett didn't notice. He's useless. Stuart, please. Please." She wanted to shout at the kids at work sometimes too. She wanted to scream. "You must accept the reality of other people. You think that reality is up for negotiation, that we think it's whatever you say it is. You must accept that we are as real as you are. You must accept that you are not God. Your father's very upset, Stu, because of Barry. Can't you understand that?" "Yes," said Fats. "I mean, it's like Arf dying would be to you." He did not respond. Nor did his expression alter much, yet she sensed his disdain, his amusement. "I know you think you and Arf are very different orders of being to the likes of your father and Barry." "No," said Fats, but only, she knew, in the hope of ending the conversation. I'm going to take some food over to Mary's house. I am begging you, Stuart, not to do anything else to upset your father while I'm gone. Please, Stu. Fine, he said, with half a laugh, half a shrug. She felt his attention swooping, swallow-like, back to his own concerns, even before she had closed the door. 6. The spiteful wind blew away the low-hanging cloud of late afternoon and at sunset died out. 3 houses along from the walls, Samantha Mollison sat facing her lamp-lit reflection in the dressing-table mirror and found the silence and the stillness depressing. It had been a disappointing couple of days. She'd sold virtually nothing. The sales rep from Champetre had turned out to be a jowly man with an abrasive manner and a hold-all full of ugly bras. Apparently he reserved his charm for the preliminaries, for in person he was all business, patronizing her, criticizing her stock, pushing for an order. She had been imagining somebody younger, taller, and sexier. She had wanted to get him and his garish underwear out of her little shop as quickly as possible. She had bought a With Deepest Sympathy card for Mary Fairbrother that lunchtime, but could not think what to write in it, because after their nightmare journey to the hospital together, a simple signature did not seem enough. Their relationship had never been close. You bumped up against each other all the time in a place as small as Pagford, but she and Miles had not really known Barry and Mary. If anything, it might have been said that they were in opposing camps, what with Howard and Barry's endless clashes about the fields. Not that she, Samantha, gave a damn one way or another. She held herself above the smallness of local politics. Tired, out of sorts, and bloated after a day of indiscriminate snacking, she wished that she and Miles were not going to dinner at her parents-in-law's. Watching herself in the mirror, she put her hands flat against the sides of her face and pulled the skin gently back towards her ears. A younger Samantha emerged by millimeters. Turning her face slowly from side to side, she examined this taut mask. Better, much better. She wondered what it would cost, how much it would hurt, whether she would dare. She tried to imagine what her mother-in-law would say if she appeared with a firm new face. Shirley and Howard were, as Shirley frequently reminded them, helping to pay for their granddaughter's education. Miles entered the bedroom. Samantha released her skin and picked up her under-eye concealer, tilting her head back as she always did when applying makeup. It pulled the slightly sagging skin at her jaw taut and minimized the pouches under her eyes. There were short, needle-deep lines at the edges of her lips. These could be filled, she had read, with a synthetic, injectable compound. She wondered how much difference that would make. It would surely be cheaper than a facelift, and perhaps Shirley would not notice. In the mirror over her shoulder, she saw Miles pulling off his tie and shirt, his big belly spilling over his work trousers.
"Weren't you meeting someone today? Some rep?" he asked. Idly he scratched his hairy navel, staring into the wardrobe.
"Yes, but it wasn't any good," said Samantha. "Crappy stuff." Miles enjoyed what she did. He'd grown up in a home where retail was the only business that mattered, and he'd never lost the respect for commerce that Howard had instilled in him. Then there were all the opportunities for jokes and for other, less subtly disguised forms of self-congratulation that her line of trade afforded. Miles never seemed to tire of making the same old quips or the same sly allusions.
"Bad fit?" he inquired knowledgeably.
"Bad design, horrible colours." Samantha brushed and tied back her thick, dry brown hair, watching Miles in the mirror as he changed into chinos and a polo shirt. She was on edge, feeling that she might snap or cry at the smallest provocation. Evertree Crescent was only a few minutes away, but Church Row was steep, so they drove. Darkness was falling properly, and at the top of the road they passed a shadowy man with Barry Fairbrother's silhouette and gait. It gave Samantha a shock, and she glanced back at him, wondering who he could be. Mars's car turned left at the top of the road, then barely a minute later right into the half moon of 1930s bungalows. Howard and Shirley's house, a low, wide-windowed building of red brick, boasted generous sweeps of green lawn at the front and back, which were mown into stripes during the summer by Miles. During the long years of their occupancy, Howard and Shirley had added carriage lamps, a white wrought-iron gate, and terracotta pots full of geraniums on either side of the front door. They had also put up a sign beside the doorbell, a round, polished piece of wood on which was written in old Gothic black lettering complete with quotation marks, Ambleside. Samantha was sometimes cruelly witty at the expense of her parents-in-law's house. Miles tolerated her jibes, accepting the implication that he and Samantha, with their stripped back floor and doors, their rugs on bare boards, their framed art prints, and their stylish, uncomfortable sofa, had the better taste, but in his secret soul, he preferred the bungalow in which he had grown up. Nearly every surface was covered with something plushy and soft. There were no drafts, and the reclining chairs were deliciously comfortable. After he mowed the lawn in the summer, Shirley would bring him a cool beer while he lay back in one of them, watching the cricket on the widescreen TV. Sometimes one of his daughters would come with him and sit beside him, eating ice cream with chocolate sauce, especially made for her granddaughters by Shirley. "Hello, darling," said Shirley when she opened the door. Her short, compact shape suggested a neat little pepper pot in its sprigged apron. She stood on tiptoe for her tall son to kiss her, then said, "Hello, Sam," and turned away immediately. "Dinner's nearly ready. Howard, Miles and Sam are here." The house smelt of furniture polish and good food. Howard emerged from the kitchen, a bottle of wine in one hand, a corkscrew in the other. In a practiced move, Shirley backed smoothly into the dining room, enabling Howard, who took up almost the entire width of the hall, to pass before she trotted into the kitchen.
"Here they are, the good Samaritans," boomed Howard. "And how's the brassiere business, Sammy? Breasting the recession all right?"
"Business is surprisingly bouncy, actually, Howard," said Samantha.
Howard roared with laughter, and Samantha was sure that he would have patted her on the bottom if he'd not been holding the corkscrew and bottle.
She tolerated all of her father-in-law's little squeezes and slaps as the harmless exhibitionism of a man grown too fat and old to do anything more. In any case, it annoyed Shirley, which always pleased Samantha. Shirley never showed her displeasure openly. Her smile did not flicker, nor did her tone of sweet reasonableness falter. But within a short time of any of Howard's mild lewdnesses, she always tossed a dart, hidden in a feathery flourish, at her daughter-in-law. Mention of the girl's escalating school fees, solicitous inquiries about Samantha's diet, asking Miles whether he did not think Mary Fairbrother had an awfully pretty figure. Samantha endured it all, smiling, and punished Miles for it later.
"Hello, Mo," said Miles, preceding Samantha into what Howard and Shirley called the lounge. "Didn't know you were going to be here."
"Hello, handsome," said Maureen, in her deep, gravelly voice. "Gimme a kiss."
Howard's widowed business partner was sitting in a corner of the sofa, clutching a tiny glass of sherry. She was wearing a fuchsia pink dress with dark stockings and high, patent leather heels. Her jet black hair was heavily lacquered into a bouffant, beneath which her face was pale and monkeyish, with a thick smear of shocking pink lipstick that puckered as Miles bent low to kiss her cheek.
"Been talking business. Plans for the new cafe." "Hello, Sam, sweetheart," Maureen added, patting the sofa beside her. "Oh, you are lovely and tanned. Is that still from Ibiza? Come sit down by me. What a shock for you at the golf club. It must have been ghastly."
"Yes, it was," said Samantha. And for the first time she found herself telling somebody the story of Barry's death, while Miles hovered, looking for a chance to interrupt. Howard handed out large glasses of Pinot Grigio, paying close attention to Samantha's account. Gradually, in the glow of Howard and Maureen's interest, with the alcohol kindling a comforting fire inside her, the tension Samantha had carried with her for 2 days seemed to drain away, and a fragile sense of well-being blossomed. The room was warm and spotless. Shelving units on either side of the gas fire displayed an array of ornamental china, nearly all of it commemorating some royal landmark or anniversary of the reign of Elizabeth II. A small bookcase in the corner contained a mixture of royal biographies and the glossy cookbooks that had overrun the kitchen. Photographs adorned the shelves and walls. Miles and his younger sister Patricia beamed from a twin frame in matching school uniforms. Miles and Samantha's two daughters, Lexi and Libby, were represented over and again from babyhood to teens. Samantha figured only once in the family gallery, though in one of the largest and most prominent pictures. It showed her and Miles's wedding day, 16 years before. Miles was young and handsome, piercing blue eyes crinkled at the cameraman, whereas Samantha's eyes were closed in a half blink, her face was turned sideways, her chin was doubled by her smile at a different lens. The white satin of her dress strained across breasts already swollen with her early pregnancy, making her look huge. One of Maureen's thin, claw-like hands was playing with the chain she always wore around her neck, on which hung a crucifix and her late husband's wedding ring. When Samantha reached the point in her story where the doctor told Mary that there was nothing they could do, Maureen put her free hand on Samantha's knee and squeezed.
"Dishing up," called Shirley.
Though she had not wanted to come, Samantha felt better than she had in 2 days. Maureen and Howard were treating her like a mixture of heroine and invalid, and both of them patted her gently on the back as she passed them on her way into the dining room. Shirley had turned down the dimmer switch and lit long pink candles to match the wallpaper and the best napkins. The steam rising from their soup plates in the gloom made even Howard's wide, florid face look otherworldly. Having drunk almost to the bottom of her big wine glass, Samantha thought how funny it would be if Howard announced they were about to hold a séance to ask Barry for his own account of the events at the golf club.
"Well," said Howard in a deep voice, "I think we ought to raise our glasses to Barry Fairbrother."
Samantha tipped back her glass quickly to stop Shirley seeing that she had already downed most of its contents.
"It was almost certainly an aneurysm," announced Miles, the instant the glasses had landed back on the tablecloth.
He had withheld this information even from Samantha, and he was glad because she might have squandered it just now while talking to Maureen and Howard.
"Gavin phoned Mary to give the firm's condolences and touch base about the will, and Mary confirmed it. Basically, an artery in his head swelled up and burst."
He had looked up the term on the internet, once he had found out how to spell it, back in his office after speaking to Gavin.
"Could have happened at any time. Some sort of inborn weakness." "Ghastly," said Howard.
But then he noticed that Samantha's glass was empty, and heaved himself out of his chair to top it up. Shirley drank soup for a while with her eyebrows hovering near her hairline. Samantha slugged down more wine in defiance. "Do you know what?" she said, her tongue slightly unwieldy. "I thought I saw him on the way here, in the dark, Barry." "I expect it was one of his brothers," said Shirley dismissively. "They're all alike." But Maureen croaked over Shirley, drowning her out.
"I thought I saw Ken the evening after he died, clear as day, standing in the garden, looking up at me through the kitchen window, in the middle of his roses."
Nobody responded. They had heard the story before. A minute passed, full of nothing but soft slurps. Then Maureen spoke again with her raven's caw.
"Gavin's quite friendly with the Fairbrothers, isn't he, Miles? Doesn't he play squash with Barry? Didn't he, I should say?"
"Yeah, Barry thrashed him once a week. Gavin must be a lousy player. Barry had 10 years on him."
Near identical expressions of complacent amusement touched the candle-lit faces of the three women around the table. If nothing else, they had in common a slightly perverse interest in Miles's stringy young business partner. In Maureen's case, this was merely a manifestation of her inexhaustible appetite for all the gossip of Pagford, and the goings-on of a young bachelor were prime meat. Shirley took a particular pleasure in hearing all about Gavin's inferiorities and insecurities because these threw into delicious contrast the achievements and self-assertion of the twin gods of her life, Howard and Miles. But in the case of Samantha, Gavin's passivity and caution awoke a feline cruelty. She had a powerful desire to see him slapped awake, pulled into line, or otherwise mauled by a feminine surrogate. She bullied him a little in person whenever they met, taking pleasure in the conviction that he found her overwhelming, hard to handle.
"So how are things going these days?" asked Maureen. "With his lady friend from London?"
"She's not in London any more, Mo. She's moved into Hope Street," said Miles. "And if you ask me, he's regretting he ever went nearer. You know Gavin. Born with cold feet."
Miles had been a few years above Gavin at school, and there was forever a trace of the sixth form prefect in the way he spoke about his business partner.
"Dark girl, very short hair."
"That's her," said Miles. "Social worker, flat shoes."
"And we've had her in the deli, haven't we, Hal?" said Maureen excitedly. "I wouldn't have had her down as much of a cook, though. Not by the look of her."
Roast loin of pork followed the soup. With the connivance of Howard, Samantha was sliding gently towards contented drunkenness, but something in her was making forlorn protests like a man swept out to sea. She attempted to drown it in more wine. A pause rolled out across the table like a fresh tablecloth, pristine and expectant, and this time everybody seemed to know that it was for Howard to set out the new topic. He ate for a while, big mouthfuls washed down with wine, apparently oblivious to their eyes upon him. Finally, having cleared half his plate, he dabbed at his mouth with his napkin and spoke.
"Yes. It will be interesting to see what happens on council now."
He was forced to pause to suppress a powerful burp. For a moment, he looked as if he might be sick. He thumped his chest.
"Pardon me."
"Yes. It'll be very interesting indeed. With Fairbrother gone."
Businesslike, Howard reverted to the form of the name he habitually used.
"I can't see this article for the paper coming off, unless Ben's your ear takes it on, obviously," he added.
Howard had dubbed Parminda Jawanda Ben's your ear Bhutto after her first attendance as a parish councillor. It was a popular joke among the anti-fielders.
"The look on her face," said Maureen, addressing Shirley. "The look on her face when we told her, well, I always thought, you know."
Samantha pricked up her ears, but Maureen's insinuation was surely laughable. Parminda was married to the most gorgeous man in Packford, Vikram, tall and well-made, with an aquiline nose, eyes fringed with thick black lashes, and a lazy, knowing smile. For years, Samantha had tossed back her hair and laughed more often than necessary whenever she paused in the street to pass the time of day with Vikram, who had the same kind of body Miles had had before he'd given up rugby and become soft and paunchy. Samantha had heard somewhere, not long after they'd become her neighbours, that Vikram and Parminda had had an arranged marriage. She found this idea unspeakably erotic. Imagine being ordered to marry Vikram, having to do it. She had wrought a little fantasy in which she was veiled and shown into a room, a virgin condemned to her fate. Imagine looking up and knowing you were getting that. Not to mention the additional frisson of his job. That much responsibility would have given a much uglier man sex appeal. Vikram had performed Howard's quadruple bypass 7 years previously. In consequence, Vikram could not enter Mollison and Lowe without being subjected to a barrage of jocular banter.
"To the head of the queue, please, Mr. Jawanda. Move aside, please, ladies. No, Mr. Jawanda, I insist. This man saved my life. Patched up the old ticker. What will it be, Mr. Jawanda, sir?"
Howard always insisted that Vikram take free samples and a little extra of everything he bought. In consequence, Samantha suspected of these antics. Vikram almost never entered the delicatessen anymore. She had lost the thread of the conversation, but it did not matter. The others were still droning on about something that Barry Fairbrother had written to the local paper.
"Was gonna have to talk to him about it," boomed Howard. "It was a very underhand way of doing things. Well, well, that's water under the bridge now. What we should be thinking about is who's going to replace Fairbrother. We shouldn't underestimate Ben's Uriah, however upset she might be. That would be a great mistake. She's probably trying to rustle up somebody already, so we ought to be thinking about a decent replacement ourselves, sooner rather than later. Simple matter of good governance."
"What will that mean exactly?" Miles asked. "An election?"
"Possibly," said Howard, with a judicious air. "But I doubt it. It's only a casual vacancy. If there isn't enough interest in an election, though, as I say, we must not underestimate Ben's Uriah, but if she can't raise 9 people to propose a public vote, it'll be a simple question of co-opting a new councillor. In that case, we'd need 9 members' votes to get the co-option ratified. 9's the quorum. 3 years of Fairbrother's term of office left to run? Worth it. Could swing the whole thing, putting one of our side in, instead of Fairbrother."
Howard drummed his thick fingers against the bowl of his wine glass, looking at his son across the table. Both Shirley and Maureen were watching Miles too, and Miles, Samantha thought, was looking back at his father like a big, fat Labrador, quivering in expectation of a treat. A beat later than she would have done if she'd been sober, Samantha realized what this was all about and why a strangely celebratory air hung over the table. Her intoxication had been liberating, but all of a sudden it was restrictive, for she was not sure that her tongue would be wholly biddable after more than a bottle of wine and a long stretch of silence. She therefore thought the words rather than speaking them aloud. "You'd better bloody well tell them you need to discuss it with me first, Miles."
7.
Tessa Wall had not meant to stay long at Mary's. She was never comfortable about leaving her husband and Fats alone in the house together, but somehow her visit had stretched to a couple of hours. The Fairbrothers' house was overflowing with camp beds and sleeping bags. Their extended family had closed in around the gaping vacuum left by death, but no amount of noise and activity could mask the chasm into which Barry had vanished. Alone with her thoughts for the first time since their friend had died, Tessa retraced her steps down Church Row in the darkness, her feet aching, her cardigan inadequate protection against the cold. The only noise was the clicking of the wooden beads around her neck, and the dim sounds of television sets in the houses she was passing. Quite suddenly, Tessa thought, "I wonder whether Barry knew." It had never occurred to her before that her husband might have told Barry the great secret of her life, the rotten thing that lay buried at the heart of her marriage. She and Colin never even discussed it, though a whiff of it tainted many a conversation, particularly lately. Tonight, though, Tessa had thought she caught half a glance from Mary at the mention of Fats. "You're exhausted and you're imagining things," Tessa told herself firmly. Colin's habits of secrecy were so strong, so deeply entrenched, that he would never have told, not even Barry, whom he idolized. Tessa hated to think that Barry might have known, that his kindness towards Colin had been actuated by pity for what she, Tessa, had done. When she entered the sitting room, she found her husband sitting in front of the television, wearing his glasses, the news on in the background. He had a sheaf of printed papers in his lap and a pen in his hand. To Tessa's relief, there was no sign of Fats. "How is she?" Colin asked.
"Well, you know, not great," said Tessa.
She sank into one of the old armchairs with a little moan of relief and pulled off her worn-down boots.
"But Barry's brother's being marvellous."
"In what way?"
"Well, you know, helping."
She closed her eyes and massaged the bridge of her nose and her eyelids with her thumb and forefinger.
"I always thought he seemed a bit unreliable," said Colin's voice.
"Really?" said Tessa,
from the depths of her voluntary darkness.
Yes. Remember when he said he'd come and referee for that game against Paxton High, and he cancelled with about half an hour's notice and Bateman had to do it instead?
Tessa fought down an impulse to snap. Colin had a habit of making sweeping judgments based on first impressions, on single actions. He never seemed to grasp the immense mutability of human nature, nor to appreciate that behind every nondescript face lay a wild and unique hinterland like his own.
"Well, he's being lovely with the kids," said Tessa carefully. "I've got to go to bed."
She did not move, but sat concentrating on the separate aches in different parts of her body, in her feet, her lower back, her shoulders.
"Tess, I've been thinking."
"Hmm?" Glasses shrank Colin's eyes to mole-like proportions so that the high, balding, knobbly forehead seemed even more pronounced.
"Everything Barry was trying to do on the parish council, everything he was fighting for, the fields, the addiction clinic, I've been thinking about it all day."
He drew a deep inward breath.
"I've pretty much decided that I'm going to take over for him."
Misgivings crashed over Tessa, pinning her to her chair, rendering her momentarily speechless. She struggled to keep her expression professionally neutral.
"I'm sure it's what Barry would have wanted," said Colin. His strange excitement was tinged with defensiveness.
"Never," said Tessa's most honest self, "never for a second would Barry have wanted you to do this. He would have known you are the very last person who ought to do it."
"Gosh," she said. "Well, I know Barry was very... But it would be a huge commitment, Colin, and it's not as though Parminda's gone. She's still there, and she'll be trying to do everything Barry wanted."
"I should have phoned Parminda," thought Tessa as she said it, with a guilty bump in her stomach.
"Oh, God, why didn't I think to call Parminda?" "But she'll need support. She'll never be able to stand up to them all on her own," said Colin. "And I guarantee Howard Monison will be lining up some puppet to replace Barry right now. He's probably already..." "Oh, Colin, I bet he has. You know what he's like."
The papers in Colin's lap fell, disregarded, in a smooth white waterfall onto the floor.
"I want to do this for Barry. I'll take over where he left off. I'll make sure everything he worked for doesn't go up in smoke. I know the arguments. He always said he got opportunities he'd never have had otherwise. And look how much he gave back to the community. I'm definitely going to stand. I'm going to look into what I've got to do tomorrow."
"All right," said Tessa. Years of experience had taught her that Colin ought not to be opposed in the first throes of his enthusiasm, or it would simply entrench him in his determination to proceed. Those same years had taught Colin that Tessa often pretended to agree before raising objections. These kinds of exchanges were always infused with their mutual, unexpressed remembrance of that long-buried secret. Tessa felt that she owed him. He felt that he was owed.
"This is something I really want to do, Tessa."
"I understand that, Colin." She pulled herself out of the chair, wondering whether she would have the energy to get upstairs.
"Are you coming to bed?"
"In a minute. I want to finish looking through these first."
He was gathering up the printed sheets he'd let fall. His reckless new project seemed to be giving him a feverish energy. Tessa undressed slowly in their bedroom. Gravity seemed to have become more powerful. It was such an effort to lift her limbs, to force her recalcitrant zip to do as she wished. She pulled on her dressing gown and went into the bathroom, where she could hear Fats moving around overhead. She often felt lonely and drained these days, shuttling between her husband and son, who seemed to exist entirely independently, as alien to each other as landlord and lodger. Tessa went to take off her wristwatch, then realized that she'd mislaid it yesterday. So tired, she kept losing things. And how could she have forgotten to call Parminda? Tearful, worried and tense, she shuffled off to bed.
Wednesday.
1.
Crystal Whedon had spent Monday and Tuesday nights on her friend Nikki's bedroom floor after an especially bad fight with her mother. This had started when Crystal arrived home from hanging out with her mates at the precinct and found Terry talking to Obbo on the doorstep. Everybody in the fields knew Obbo, with his bland, puffy face and his gap-toothed grin, his bottle-bottomed glasses and his filthy old leather jacket.
"Just keep him here for us, Tear, for a couple of days. Few quid in it for you." "What's she keeping?"
Crystal had demanded. Robbie scrambled out from between Terry's legs to cling tightly to Crystal's knees. Robbie did not like men coming to the house. He had good reason.
"Nothing, computers."
"Don't," Crystal had said to Terry. She did not want her mother to have spare cash. She would not have put it past Obbo to cut out the middle step and pay her for the favour with a bag of smack.
"Don't take him."
But Terry had said yes. All Crystal's life, her mother had said yes to everything and everyone, agreeing, accepting, forever acquiescing.
"Yeah, all right, go on then, here you go, no problem."
Crystal had gone out later to hang out at the swings under a darkening sky with her friends. She felt strained and irritable. She could not seem to grasp the fact of Mr. Fairbrother's death, but kept experiencing punches to the stomach that made her want to lash out at somebody. She was also unsettled and guilty about having stolen Tessa Wall's watch.
But why had the silly bitch put it there in front of Crystal and closed her eyes? What did she expect?
Being with the others did not help. Gemma kept needling her about Fats Wall. Finally, Crystal exploded and lunged at her. Nicky and Leanne had to hold Crystal back. So Crystal stormed home to find that Obbo's computers had arrived. Robbie was trying to climb the stacked boxes in the front room, while Terry sat there in dazed oblivion, her works lying out on the floor. As Crystal had feared, Obbo had paid Terry with a bag of heroin.
"You stupid fucking junkie bitch, they'll kick you out the fucking clinic again."
But heroin took Crystal's mother where she was beyond reach. Though she responded by calling Crystal a little bitch and a whore, it was with vacant detachment. Crystal slapped Terry across the face. Terry told her to fuck off and die.
"You fucking look after him for a fucking change then, you useless fucking smackhead cow,"
Crystal screamed. Robbie ran howling up the hall after her, but she slammed the front door on him. Crystal liked Nicky's house better than any other. It was not as tidy as her Nana Cat's, but it was friendlier, comfortingly loud and busy. Nicky had two brothers and a sister, so Crystal slept on a folded-up duvet between the sisters' beds. The walls were covered with pictures cut out of magazines, arranged as a collage of desirable boys and beautiful girls. It had never occurred to Crystal to embellish her own bedroom walls. But guilt was gnawing at her insides. She kept remembering Robbie's terrified face as she slammed the door on him, so on Wednesday morning she came home. In any case, Nicky's family was not keen on her staying more than two nights in a row. Nicky had once told her, with characteristic forthrightness, that it was all right with her mum if it didn't happen too often, but that Crystal was to stop using them as a hostel and especially to stop turning up past midnight. Terry seemed as glad as she ever was to see Crystal back. She talked about the new social worker's visit, and Crystal wondered nervously what the stranger had thought of the house, which lately had sunk even further below its usual filthy tide mark. Crystal was especially worried that Kay had found Robbie at home when he ought to have been at nursery, because Terry's commitment to keeping Robbie in preschool, which he had begun while with his foster mother, had been a key condition of his negotiated return to the family home the previous year. She was also furious that the social worker had caught Robbie wearing a nappy after all the work Crystal had put in to persuade him to use the toilet.
"So what does she say?" Crystal demanded of Terry.
"Told me she was going to come back," said Terry.
Crystal had a bad feeling about this. Their usual social worker seemed content to let the Whedon family get along without much interference, vague and haphazard, often getting their names wrong and confusing their circumstances with those of other clients. She turned up every 2 weeks with no apparent aim except to check that Robbie was still alive. The new menace worsened Crystal's mood. When straight, Terry was cowed by her daughter's anger and let Crystal boss her around. Making the most of her temporary authority, Crystal ordered Terry to put on some proper clothes, forced Robbie back into clean pants, reminded him he couldn't piss in this kind, and marched him off to the nursery. He bawled when she made to leave. At first, she got ratty with him, but finally she crouched down and promised him that she would come back and pick him up at one, and he let her go. Then Crystal truanted, even though Wednesday was the day she liked best at school, because she had both PE and guidance, and set to work to clean up the house a bit, sloshing pine-scented disinfectant over the kitchen, scraping all the old food and cigarette butts into bin liners. She hid the biscuit tin holding Terry's works and heaved the remaining computers, three had already been collected, into the hall cupboard. All the time she was chiseling food off the plates, Crystal's thoughts kept returning to the rowing team. She would have had practice the following night, if Mr. Fairbrother had still been alive. He usually gave her a lift both ways in the people carrier because she had no other means of getting over to the canal in Yarville. His twin daughters, Siobhan and Neve, and Sukhvinder Jawanda came in the car too. Crystal had no regular contact with these three girls during school hours, but since becoming a team, they'd always said, "All right," when they passed each other in the corridors. Crystal had expected them to look down their noses at her, but they were okay once you got to know them. They laughed at her jokes. They had adopted some of her favorite phrases. She was, in some sense, the crew leader. Nobody in Crystal's family had ever owned a car. If she concentrated, she could smell the interior of the people carrier, even over the stink of Terry's kitchen. She loved its warm, plasticky scent. She would never be in that car again. There had been trips on a hired minibus, too, with Mr. Fairbrother driving the whole team, and sometimes they'd stayed overnight when they competed against far-flung schools. The team had sung Rihanna's Umbrella in the back of the bus. It had become their lucky ritual, their theme tune, with Crystal doing Jay-Z's rap solo at the start. Mr. Fairbrother had nearly pissed himself the first time he heard her do it.
"Uh-huh, uh-huh, Rihanna. Good girl gone bad. Take three. Action. No clouds in my storms. Let it rain. A hydroplane into fame. Coming down with the Dow Jones."
Crystal had never understood the words. Cubby Wall had sent round a letter to them all, saying that the team would not be meeting until they could find a new coach, but they would never find a new coach, so that was a pile of shit. They all knew that. It had been Mr. Fairbrother's team, his pet project. Crystal had taken a load of abuse from Nicky and the others for joining. Their sneering had hidden incredulity and, later on, admiration because the team had won medals. Crystal kept hers in a box she'd stolen from Nicky's house. Crystal was much given to sneaking things into her pockets that belonged to people she liked. This box was plastic and decorated with roses. A child's jewellery box, really. Tessa's watch was curled up inside it now. The best time of all had been when they'd beaten those snotty little bitches from St. Anne's. That day had been the very best of Crystal's life. The headmistress had called the team up in front of the whole school at the next assembly. Crystal had been a bit mortified, Nicky and Leanne had been laughing at her, but then everyone had applauded them. It had meant something, that Winterdown had hammered St. Anne's. But it was all finished, all over. The trips in the car, and the rowing, and the talking to the local newspaper. She'd liked the idea of being in the newspaper again. Mr. Fairbrother had said he was going to be there with her when it happened, just the two of them. "What will they want to talk to me about, like?" "Your life. They're interested in your life, like a celebrity." Crystal had no money for magazines, but she saw them in Nicky's house, and at the doctor's, if she took Robbie. This would have been even better than being in the paper with the team. She had burst with excitement at the prospect, but somehow she'd managed to keep her mouth shut and had not even boasted about it to Nicky or Leanne. She had wanted to surprise them. It was as well she'd not said anything. She would never be in the paper again. There was a hollowness in Crystal's stomach. She tried not to think any more about Mr. Fairbrother as she moved around the house, cleaning inexpertly but doggedly, while her mother sat in the kitchen, smoking and staring out of the back window. Shortly before midday, a woman pulled up outside the house in an old blue Vauxhall. Crystal caught sight of her from Robbie's bedroom window. The visitor had very short, dark hair and was wearing black trousers, a beaded, ethnic sort of necklace, and carrying a large tote bag over her shoulder that seemed to be full of files. Crystal ran downstairs.
"I think it's her,"
she called to Terry, who was in the kitchen.
"The social."
The woman knocked, and Crystal opened the door. "Hello, I'm Kay. I'm covering for Matty. You must be Crystal."
"Yeah,"
said Crystal, not bothering to return Kay's smile. She showed her into the sitting room and saw her take in its new, ramshackle tidiness. The emptied ashtray and most of the stuff lying around had been crammed onto the broken shelves. The carpet was still filthy, because the Hoover did not work, and the towel and the zinc ointment were lying on the floor, with one of Robbie's matchbox cars perched on the top of the plastic tub. Crystal had tried to distract Robbie with the car while she scraped his bottom clean.
"Robbie's at nursery," Crystal told Kay. "I've took him. I've put him back in pants. She keeps putting him back in pull-ups. I told her not to. I've put cream on his bum. It'll be all right. It's only nappy rash."
Kay smiled at her again. Crystal peered around the doorway and shouted,
"Mum!"
Terry joined them from the kitchen. She was wearing a dirty old sweatshirt and jeans and looked better for being more covered up.
"Hello, Terry," said Kay.
"All right,"
said Terry, taking a deep drag from her cigarette.
"Sit down,"
Crystal instructed her mother, who obeyed, curling up in the same chair as before.
"Do you want a cup of tea or summat?"
Crystal asked Kay. "That'd be great," said Kay, sitting down and opening her folder. "Thanks." Crystal hurried out of the room. She was listening carefully, trying to make out what Kay was saying to her mother.
"You probably weren't expecting to see me again this soon, Terry," she heard Kay say. She had a strange accent. It sounded like a London one, like the posh new bitch at school half the boys had stiffies for.
"But I was quite concerned about Robbie yesterday. He's back at nursery today," Crystal says.
"Yeah," said Terry. "She took him. She come back this morning."
"She's come back. Where has she been?"
"I just been at just slept over at a friend's," said Crystal,
hurrying back to the sitting room to speak for herself.
"Yeah, but she come back this morning," said Terry.
Crystal went back to the kettle. It made such a racket as it came to the boil that she could not make out what any of her mother and the social worker were saying to each other. She sloshed milk into the mugs with the tea bags, trying to be as quick as possible, then carried the three red-hot mugs through to the sitting room in time to hear Kay say,
"Spoke to Mrs. Harper at the nursery yesterday."
"That bitch," said Terry.
"There you are," Crystal told Kay, setting the teas on the floor and turning one of the mugs so that its handle faced her.
"Thanks very much," Kay said.
"Terry, Mrs. Harper told me that Robbie has been absent a lot over the last 3 months. He hasn't had a full week for a while, has he?"
"What?" said Terry. "No, he ain't." "Yeah, he has. He only just missed yesterday, and when he had his sore throat."
"When was that?"
"What? Month ago? Month and a half? About?"
Crystal sat down on the arm of her mother's chair. She glared down at Kay from her position of height, energetically chewing gum, her arms folded like her mother's. Kay had a thick, open folder on her lap. Crystal hated folders, all the stuff they wrote about you and kept and used against you afterwards.
"I takes Robbie to the nursery," she said, "on my way to school."
"Well, according to Mrs. Harper, Robbie's attendance has fallen off quite a bit," said Kay, looking down the notes she'd made of her conversation with the nursery manager. "The thing is, Terry, you did commit to keeping Robbie in preschool when he was returned to you last year."
"I ain't fucking..." Terry began.
"No, shut up, right,"
Crystal said loudly to her mother. She addressed Kay.
"He were ill, right? His tonsils were all up. I got him antibiotics off the doctor."
"And when was that?"
"That was about 3 weeks. Anyway, right, when I was here yesterday," Kay said, addressing Robbie's mother again.
Crystal was chewing vigorously, her arms making a double barrier around her ribs,
You seem to be finding it very difficult to respond to Robbie's needs, Terry. Crystal glanced down at her mother. Her spreading thigh was twice as thick as Terry's.
I didn't. I never.
Terry changed her mind.
He's fine.
A suspicion darkened Crystal's mind like the shadow of some circling vulture. Terry, you'd used when I arrived yesterday, hadn't you?
No, I fucking hadn't. That's a fucking... You're fucking... I ain't used, all right?
A weight was pressing on Crystal's lungs and her ears were ringing. Obbo must have given her mother not a single bag, but a bundle. The social worker had seen her blasted. Terry would test positive at Bell Chapel the next day, and they would chuck her out again. And without methadone, they would return again to that nightmare place where Terry became feral, when she would again start opening her broken-toothed mouth for strangers' dicks so she could feed her veins. And Robbie would be taken away again, and this time he might not come back. In a little red plastic heart hanging from the key ring in Crystal's pocket was a picture of Robbie, aged one. Crystal's real heart had started pounding the way it did when she rowed full stretch, pulling, pulling through the water, her muscles singing, watching the other team slide backwards.
You fucking...
she shouted, but nobody heard her, because Terry was still bawling at Kay, who sat with her mug held in her hands, looking unmoved.
I ain't fucking used. You ain't got no proof. You fucking stupid,
said Crystal louder.
I ain't fucking used. That's a fucking lie,
screamed Terry, an animal snared in a net, thrashing around, tangling herself tighter.
I never fucking did, right? I never. They'll kick you out the fucking clinic again, you stupid fucking bitch. Don't you dare fucking talk to me like that.
All right, said Kay loudly over the din, putting her mug back on the floor and standing up, scared at what she'd unleashed. Then she shouted, Terry! In real alarm, as Terry hoisted herself up in the chair to half-crouch on its other arm, facing her daughter, like two gargoyles they were almost nose-to-nose, screaming.
Crystal!
Cried Kay, as Crystal raised her fist. Crystal flung herself violently off the chair away from her mother. She was surprised to feel warm liquid flowing down her cheeks and thought confusedly of blood, but it was tears, only tears, clear and shining on her fingertips when she wiped them away. All right, said Kay, unnerved. Let's calm down, please.
You fucking calm down,
Crystal said. Shaking, she wiped her face with her forearm, then marched back over to her mother's chair. Terry flinched, but Crystal merely snatched up the cigarette packet, slid out the last cigarette and a lighter, and lit up. Puffing on the cigarette, she walked away from her mother to the window and turned her back, trying to press away more tears before they fell. Okay, said Kay, still standing. If we can talk about this calmly...
Oh, fuck off, said Terry, dully.
This is about Robbie, Kay said. She was still on her feet, scared to relax. That's what I'm here for, to make sure that Robbie is all right.
So he missed fucking nursery,
said Crystal from the window.
That's not a fucking crime. It's not a fucking crime, agreed Terry in a dim echo.
This isn't only about nursery, said Kay. Robbie was uncomfortable and sore when I saw him yesterday. He's much too old to be wearing a nappy.
I took him out the fucking nappy. He's in pants now, I told you,
said Crystal furiously. I'm sorry, Terry, said Kay, but you weren't in any fit condition to have sole charge of a small child.
I never...
You can't keep telling me you haven't used, Kay said. And Crystal heard something real and human in Kay's voice for the first time. Exasperation, irritation. But you're going to be tested at the clinic. We both know you're going to test positive. They're saying it's your last chance, that they'll throw you out again. Terry wiped her mouth with the back of her hand. Look, I can see neither of you wants to lose Robbie.
Don't fucking take him away then,
shouted Crystal. It's not as simple as that, said Kay. She sat down again and lifted the heavy folder back onto her lap from the floor where it had fallen. When Robbie came back to you last year, Terry, you were off the heroin. You made a big commitment to staying clean and going through the program, and you agreed to certain other things, like keeping Robbie in nursery.
Yeah, and I took him for a bit, said Kay.
For a bit you did. But, Terry, a token effort isn't enough. After what I found when I called here yesterday, and after talking to your key drug worker and to Mr. Harper, I'm afraid I think we need to have another look at how things are working.
What's that mean?
Said Crystal.
Another fucking case review, is it? Why'd you need one, though? Why'd you need one? He's all right. I'm looking after... Fucking shut up!
She screamed at Terry, who was trying to shout along from her chair.
She ain't... I'm looking after him, all right?
She bellowed at Kay, pink in the face, her heavily cold eyes brimming with tears of anger, jabbing a finger at her own chest. Crystal had visited Robbie regularly at his foster parents during the month he had been away from them. He had clung to her, wanted her to stay for tea, cried when she left. It had been like having half your guts cut out of you and held hostage. Crystal had wanted Robbie to go to Nana Cass, the way she had gone all those times in her childhood whenever Terry had fallen apart. But Nana Cath was old and frail now, and she had no time for Robbie. I understand that you love your brother and that you're doing your best for him, Crystal, Kay said, but you're not Robbie's legal...
Why ain't I? I'm his fucking sister, and I...
All right, said Kay firmly. Terry, I think we need to face facts here. Bellchapel will definitely throw you off the program if you turn up, claim you haven't used, and then test positive. Your drug worker made that perfectly clear to me on the phone. Shrunken in the armchair, a strange hybrid of old lady and child with her missing teeth, Terry's gaze was vacant and inconsolable. I think the only way you can possibly avoid being thrown out, Kay went on, is to admit up front that you've used... Take responsibility for the lapse and show your commitment to turning over a new leaf. Terry simply stared. Lying was the only way Terry knew to meet her many accusers.
Yeah, all right, go on then, give it here. And then, no, I never, no I ain't, I never fucking did.
Was there any particular reason you used heroin this week, when you're already on a big dose of methadone? Kay asked.
Yeah, said Crystal. Yeah, because Obbo turned up and she never fucking says no to him.
Shut up, said Terry, but without heat. She seemed to be trying to take in what Kay had said to her, this bizarre, dangerous advice about telling the truth. Obbo, repeated Kay. Who's Obbo?
Fucking tosser, said Crystal.
Your dealer? Asked Kay.
Shut up, Terry advised Crystal again. Why didn't you just tell him fucking no?
Crystal shouted at her mother. All right, said Kay again. Terry, I'm going to call your drug worker back. I'm going to try and persuade her that I think there would be a benefit to the family from your staying on the program.
Will you?
Asked Crystal, astonished. She'd been thinking of Kay as a huge bitch, a bigger bitch even than that foster mother with her spotless kitchen and the way she had of speaking kindly to Crystal, which made Crystal feel like a piece of shit. Yes, said Kay, I will, but Terry, as far as we're concerned, I mean the child protection team, this is serious. We're going to have to monitor Robbie's home situation closely. We need to see a change, Terry.
All right, yeah, said Terry.
Agreeing as she agreed to everything, to everyone. But Crystal said,
You will, yeah? She will. I'll help her. She will.
2. Shirley Mollison spent Wednesdays at Southwest General in Yarville. Here, she and a dozen fellow volunteers performed non-medical jobs, such as pushing the library trolley around the beds, looking after patients' flowers and making trips to the shops in the lobby for those who were bedridden and without visitors. Shirley's favourite activity was going from bed to bed, taking orders for meals. Once, carrying her clipboard and wearing her laminated pass, she had been mistaken by a passing doctor for a hospital administrator. The idea of volunteering had come to Shirley during her longest ever conversation with Julia Fawley, during one of the wonderful Christmas parties at Sweet Love House. Here, she'd learned that Julia was involved in fundraising for the pediatric wing of the local hospital.
"What we really need is a royal visit," Julia had said, her eyes straying to the door over Shirley's shoulder. "I'm going to get Aubrey to have a quiet word with Norman Bailey. Excuse me, I must say hello to Lawrence."
Shirley was left standing there beside the grand piano saying, "Oh, of course," to thin air. She had no idea who Norman Bailey was, but she felt quite light-headed. The very next day,